Welcome to What the Hex, your source for Warhammer Underworlds in 30 glory or less. I'm your host, Davey, and with me tonight I've got Phil and Aaron. How are you guys doing?
Pretty good, but I'm not going to promise less than 30 glory. I'm not going to pull my punches.
Oh, man. Wow. Aaron, just with all the confidence in the world here.
Yeah. Coming out the gate hard.
Yeah. What he's not telling you is that's over the course of his entire Underworld's career that he's getting that 30.
Yeah. Wait, what were you talking about?
Well, as always, I like to mention our context here. We're recording a little bit before Adepticon in 2019. We've had the second banned and restricted list has come out, but we're still waiting on the last two warbands of Night Vault. So that is the context with which to consume this information. Thanks, as always, to everyone who reaches out. You can always get us at WTHcast, and we'll talk a little bit more about that at the end of the show. But we're going to start out with what we're doing. Phil, what have you been up to in Underworlds lately?
So I've been refining my Magors deck, which I'm going to be bringing to AdeptCon, and getting paint on those guys so that I can at least have base coats. It's a real low bar to hurdle, but I figured that's, you know, you start somewhere, right?
Yeah.
So that's pretty much it for the Shadespire side of things. And then with the new Khorne book coming out and doing Magors, I figured I should jump into the whole AOS Khorne side of things. So starting a new army, that'll be a longer project because I'm planning to do a lot of conversions with this one.
Oh, wow. Do you have much conversion experience? I guess I can't.
I do not. Okay. It's sort of a new thing I wanted to try out. Probably going to be working a lot with Eric from Mortal Realms crew. He does a lot of that. Stone Monk Gamer for people who are
never
only
heard
familiar.
Of him.
Never heard of the guy.
Yeah, he gets wild with him. So does Paul. But that's cool. What is your Khorne army? Basically, your war bands from Underworlds at this point, or do you have other stuff already?
Well, I have the demon half of Khorne from Wrath and Rapture box, okay. And then I just through happenstance got a bunch of stuff today, just from somebody who was getting out of the hobby. Who's just sort of trying to offload a bunch of stuff. Mm-hmm. So, like, 3 full boxes of stuff for free.
What?
Yeah. All
right.
So, pretty cool.
Who are you people getting free stuff all over the place? You, Eric?
It's all from the same guy who is unfortunately having to leave the hobby for medical reasons.
Oh. Okay, well, now I feel bad. Yeah. that I didn't get any free stuff.
Jeez.
Well, yes, of course.
And then last question about that. What do you have any idea of, like, I'll have an army ready for X event?
Not really. I mean, I'm trying to do this one where I'm more strict about actually getting it painted. So we'll see how that goes. Be kind of cool to have it 2,000 points ready sort of next year for tournament scene, though.
Yeah. All right. Cool. Speaking of warbands making you feel like you want to do a full army of something, I'm excited. I'm painting the Godsworn right now, and I was like, oh, I could paint the entire Godsworn, the entire Dark Oath range. And then, which is a warband and 2 heroes.
Yeah.
I was thinking, because I actually have a number of Marauder Cavs. Like, yeah, actually, these guys they're a close enough fit for sure. I could do them up. I'm not willing to do the Marauders on foot. Those are a little too Schwarzenegger for me. But I'm enjoying the figs. And weirdly, when I first saw them, I was like, I don't like those at all. But once I started playing and painting them, I'm down. So yeah, same. I'm the flip side of that coin. I've been training up my Godsworn Hunt, refining that deck. So I've been also checking out the Bat Reps for Salvation. It's the video battle reports that Battle for Salvation podcast puts out. They've got, I think his name is Rob Mead, who's not actually on their cast proper, but he does them on the side. If you're, the production is a lot further down than some of the other ones that you might see. There's a lot of background noise, but it's some pretty quality play. And I found I usually watch them doing dishes or something like that. And it's good enough once your ear kind of tunes in, you got it. And there's good quality play. And then Randall Slate, when he's on there, he does a good job of kind of explaining here's why this happened or here's why these choices were made. So if you're looking for something else, go check those out. They're pretty fun. The last thing I would say is Flying Phoenix Games up in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. If that's close enough to you, go check it out. Apparently they have like 12 people every couple of weeks showing up for tournaments. So it's about an hour and a half away from us. We might look at making a run up there for one of those. But he reached out after listening to the podcast. That was super cool. Appreciate that, Kevin. And getting ready for this. The other thing I was going to say is... So wigglehammer.wordpress.com. That's Jonathan Davis. He is collecting data from tournaments worldwide, calculating each faction's win rates and other data. And it's obviously only going to be as good as what he puts in. But what he's trying to do is get enough results to get a big enough sample size where he's got some idea of how people are doing. Because even when we're looking at these individual big events, there's relatively few of them. And that the data isn't, you know, from a statistical perspective, necessarily all that robust. So what he's trying to do is get to that point. So he's got about 400 matches in already from 20 different events. What he's looking for is to get info, especially if you're tournament organizer using Best Coast Pairings app. But I think he can also do it if you can tell him who played what and if you have a real detailed breakdown of your tournament. Anyway, go check it out at his site and it help. It's kind of like a little community project. See what information we can collect. Anyway, so that's what I've been doing in the Underworld's hobby. Aaron, how about you, man?
Well, it just when it comes to Wigglehammer, like I feel like I am not the target audience for that at all. And yet I've checked it out a few times now, and it actually is super pretty interesting. I think it scratches my data itch. So
sure. So maybe you are the target audience.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. Like maybe it doesn't matter what the subject matter is. If you present me with data, I will dive right into it.
Yeah. This is the same guy cool. who does the live or the living document of links and community resources. So kind of our second episode, he maintains a page of that. That's the one that's linked direct from underworldsdb.com. So if you ever feel like you are needing some more, go check and see if anything new has popped up there. Anyway, besides looking at spreadsheets, Aaron, what else are you doing?
Sure. Well, that leads me to another thing. This is maybe not noteworthy for you guys, but like I've played a couple games since last time we recorded. So like for every like 10 games you guys play, I play two. So Phil has been kind enough to dumb his play down and indulge me.
I don't know if I'd say that.
Well, at the very least you're willing to hold my hand as we go through and play. So I've fired up little aggro Stormcast Steelhearts deck. Actually, I think I might have gotten it from Wigglehammer, whether it was one of his from like the database or one of his that he put together. I can't remember.
Okay.
But played Phil's Magors, and so that's good to sort of A, try a different warband than my Skaven, and B, sort of shake off the cobwebs a little bit. Cool. I did finish putting my Reavers together. I'm also kind of in a Khorne mindset, which I think I might have mentioned before. So I think I'll probably jump on Magors just to get them assembled here pretty quick. And one of my favorite parts of the hobby, buying stuff. but all the Night Vault warbands that are out, the foam for those are in the mail from Germany right now. So I should be getting those any day now. Pretty jazzed about that.
Cool, yeah. And I don't know why we can never remember to do this. I need to raid you for your old stuff so I can preserve.
It's got your name on them.
Yeah, all right. All right. Well, that's what we've been doing. I didn't even talk about what our subject is. We were talking about how to prep, not for the apocalypse, although maybe that's another topic.
I'll just guess stay busy.
Yeah, prepping for an event or prepping for a tournament, something that we've been doing lately with our plans to go to Adepticon, Phil and I. So we're going to cover picking your faction deck, practicing and iterating with that, and then sort of some day of or the day before considerations. I'll just run down that here. For example, like you've got an event coming up, you got to pick what you're going to bring, and this could be a full on thing. But Phil, when you're picking for Adepticon, like what were the considerations? Like, what are you thinking of when you're deciding what you're gonna bring to that event?
So personally, I was trying to switch tactics a little bit from what we were doing at Waupaca. So I was playing a really control heavy, trying to score objectives, the objective hexes, not the objective cards, type of Eyes of the Nine. So I was trying to switch up to just a different style, just so I'd have something different to play. But I think when you're trying to pick a faction in general, I think you've got to figure sort of what, I don't know. When I approach tournaments, I sort of try to think of like, what can I do well with that I'm also going to enjoy playing? Because while you could maybe find a list that's going to be very strong and win a tournament for you, if you're going to hate playing it, it's probably not even worth doing.
Mm-hmm. Who hates winning?
Well, you know, I could see that argument, but at the same time, I think there are certain strategies that I personally wouldn't enjoy winning with. But yeah, so I sort of narrowed down to aggro decks, and then from there got to Magors, just out of liking the sort of Khorne hyper-aggressive style.
Sure. So I think what you're getting at is like, what are you going to... You're saying enjoyment is a big factor, and like some of that is might be like, I particularly like this style, or I'd really like to try a new style, is some of those. And then you're also looking at what's powerful. So like, if you want to bring aggro, Magors or Molochs are like a good one, choice that's going to be powerful at the same time as doing it. Like, they certainly have more obvious tools than, for instance, like aggro dwarves, Dwarden, slayers. Like those are a little different. Now, I think the other thing there is like the dark horse factor, right? So like, if you're picking somebody, if you do pick aggro slayers, there's a lot fewer people who are going to be aware of all the different cards. And so that, for me, like I find that kind of fun to, consider that as a possibility for picking. You know, if you've got a long lead time, you can try something totally new. If it's real important to you to do well, then you're also going to look at what style and what warband are you already good at, already comfortable with. So it's a big deal if you've been playing nothing but Molochs for quite a while, then switching to Sepulchral Guard, it's going to be a real grind the gears moment.
Yeah.
Take you a while to get spun up. So balancing all those, with me for this most recent one, ending up picking Godsworn Hunt, it was some because I like the idea of a little bit of a dark horse factor. It's because I've been playing them more lately, and I felt like I'd like to leverage that. They've got some overlap with the style of the Reavers, which I'd been playing before that, so I feel like I can use a lot of the lessons learned from there, and I can kind of build on that. And this, you know, Adepticon is probably going to be the biggest event we go to this year, I would imagine, unless something else pops up. So those are all factors.
To your point about considering what you're already good at, not only does it like help you maybe have a better showing, but furthermore, I feel like it maybe makes for a better tournament experience, and that like, you know, your stuff that much better, and like maybe to make your games quicker, or it's maybe a more enjoyable game for your opponent because you're not sort of stumbling over some stuff. So it's not just how well you perform, but like, well, but then it's also how well you perform, which is to say that like how well you play the game, right? And make it a more enjoyable match for the people you're playing against.
And then the last thing on picking is, what do you expect to face? And I think a lot of times when we have this conversation, so what I'm saying here is like, if you think that there's going to be a lot of horde warbands or whatever the case may be, then maybe a Farstrider's Plink deck where you're doing lots of little easy to pick off a lot of little guys or something like that is what you might consider going for. I think what's important to remember here is it makes a big difference if you're showing up for, you know, 166 people for the Warhammer World Grand Clash, where the breakdown probably looks pretty similar to what people think of as the global meta, versus something a lot more local where, hey, I know nobody's really running Molochs here, and if somebody does run Molochs, they are probably not all that practiced at it or something like that. So when you're making your pick, maybe think about don't just assume that what you're going into is the grander meta. And then also bear that in mind if you're looking at other people's results. That's kind of how we got to where we're picking our faction deck. I think then the big bulk of the time is once you've made that decision, practicing and then making those iterations, the iterative changes to your deck, figuring out, I guess refining is maybe another way of saying it. So when it comes to this, like by definition, you do not have enough time to test every possible situation, right? Like even the people who play a crazy amount, I've got my warband. If I want to do one match against every other warband just to test each of those, that's 14 matchups. That's at least two games per, maybe as many as three. So it's 28 to 42 games if I want to test every matchup. And even then, that's not every archetype for that matchup. You know, that's not, there's aggro nine versus control nine or whatever the case may be. So you got to find a way to make the most of that limited time.
Yeah, definitely. And I would argue that when you're thinking about those matchups, you sort of, or at least maybe we can assume that there's sort of an agreed upon hierarchy of which warbands are maybe easier to play. I won't necessarily say stronger, because I feel like every warband can win. But I think some, it's just sort of easier than with others. And so you can kind of focus on those ones that are maybe likely to be played because they are sort of, they have that slight edge. Mm-hmm.
Right. So I think you're looking to practice against, whatever you think are the ones you're going to be there in great numbers, and then that often coincides with what people are perceived to be the more powerful warbands. And I think another good one is to identify, like, what is your tough matchup, right? Like, what matchup am I going to struggle against? And let me get some extra reps on that. And for me, I've been fortunate because I think Godsworn have a potentially pretty tough matchup against Magors. And so I've gotten to run that a whole bunch with you.
Yeah, for sure.
And it's definitely given me give me some of the ideas of like some of the micro decisions, like, you know, is it worth dropping Dark Destiny on Grawl or whatever the case may be? Like, how is it? I don't really care about that guy, but maybe I do care about denying Magor the snowball effect of all the objectives to score immediately that you might score off that early kill. So that's an example of finding out like what feels like a real tough matchup and getting a lot of reps in on that so that you have a fighting chance when you do come up against it. So,
well, and furthermore, when you talk about how there's the 14 possible matchups and, you know, I have to, however many games, 28 to something games, like obviously it'd be real tricky to try and catch all of those. But if you are focusing both on those specific matchups that you think are probably going to either be troublesome or going to be very persistent at whatever you're going to, like, otherwise you could maybe just spend some time hitting up like just archetypes that are just general, like that are indicative of like a wide range of different warbands. Just how do I fare against mid-sized aggro decks, or how do I fare against, you know, large swarms as a whole, so that at the very least, if you can't hit every single warband or every single iteration, you can have a general idea of how you would handle those types of opponents. Yeah. Just so you can go into it with some sort of game plan.
So I'm going to put you on the spot here, Phil, and this is not something I've prepped you for, but if let's say you're getting ready to bring your Magors to a tournament. Oh, hey, you are. And you've got you got time for five matchups between now and go time. Given what you feel like the current global meta is, like what matchups, what are you going to spend those five on for you? Assuming that most of your time has been spent running against Godsworn. So you got that one locked down. You know how to do that.
So. Yeah. So I think when you're looking at Magors, you're kind of thinking from a very aggressive standpoint, but maybe not as glass cannon as something like Reavers. So other aggro matchups are kind of okay in the whole. So you're like, you can kind of rule out things like Reavers and Aggro Stormcast and Aggro Dwarves and Iron Jaws sort of off the bat, because you're kind of like, they're mirroring what I'm doing, so they're going to feed into what I want to do anyway.
Right. So you're saying like that's not somewhere you're going to spend a ton of your time and resources on?
No, I don't think so, because I think those sort of work just to your strategy no matter what. They're just going to kind of do what you want them to do. Mm-hmm. I think where it gets harder for aggro matchups is with Molly, and that's just because he's so hard to kill that trying to score those aggro objectives against him when he's running aggro against you, it's this sort of uphill battle from the get-go, because you're not going to get as many kills.
Yeah, and I think what's important there is that although he is absolutely an aggro playstyle, he is so much different. He plays a lot different than the other aggro warbands. Like, the makeup is so weird compared to the other, so he's worth playing. So spending one plus on Molly G, one or two of your five. Yep. There. Okay.
Yep, for sure. I think the Curse Breakers, just from a sense of like they're good at everything and not really bad at anything. They have high survivability, they can score easily, they're pretty good at controlling the board, although their limited model count maybe hurts them in that sense. They have range. They sort of are the jack of all trades, but kind of masters of everything, which is makes them a problem.
Masters of all trades.
Yeah. And so they're definitely worth some focus on. And knowing that they have strong infection cards, you kind of know that people are going to probably be bringing them. And then I think the Briar Thorns are strong, although I think they're less worrisome for Magors, just because Chain Rasps are sort of easy fodder.
You can Pac-Man your way through those. And
yeah.
And then to Aaron's point, I think your Thorns are kind of almost serving a dual purpose there. Like, if you deal with Thorns, then you're probably cool with Sepulchral Guard, right? Like,
right.
And Sepulchral Guard will feel like, you know, that same matchup, only two levels up on the ladder as far as easy. There's still some changes, so I guess, again, in the ideal situation, you're practicing against both. But yeah, I think a lot of lessons are applicable over.
Yeah, I think it sort of gives you the swarm factor, and they have enough in faction scoring that's pretty easy that they give you a little bit, I think, of a harder matchup than Sepulchral Guard do. Although they don't have the ability to bring fighters back, so you don't really have to think about that in that matchup. But I think for Magors, that's not something you have to worry about too much. So let's see, that's three. I think for a defensive matchup, if someone is bringing defensive Stormcast, which I feel like has sort of fallen off in terms of favored lists to run, but I think if someone were to run it, it's a really hard matchup for Magors, I think, just because you have like you have to get to them, right? Like, you're not gonna score anything, or not a lot, just from walking around getting to them. And if you're stuck in hallway and they're backboarded and you don't have a good way to jump across the board, it could be, you know, the end of round two before you're even engaged in combat, and that's not a good place to be for Magors.
Right.
So I think any defensive matchup probably works for that, but I think Stormcast do defensive builds well. And then I think for sort of other, you know, just to put stuff, because at that point you're not so focused on like strategies or general picture, you're focused on like, okay, I've done sort of the big matchups, who's like a one-off that I think is going to be problematic or that I need to make sure I practice against because they're different. And in that vein, I'll sort of answer the last one as three, and that would be Isenine, the Skaven, and Farstriders, because they all do something different, and they're all just a little bit harder to sort of pair against.
So for your fifth match, you're going to set up three simultaneous games and play them like Bobby Fischer style all at the same time.
Yes, of course.
Let me ask you this. What value do you see in practicing the mirror match? Because if you're bringing Magors, there's actually a decent chance you're going to fight another Magors. Is there...
I think it's sort of like I said with a lot of the other aggro matchups where you don't have to worry so much about like, well, how am I going to deal with what they're doing? You know what they're doing. They're wanting to kill you. You want to kill them. It's just going to turn into a bloodbath. And I think in a lot of those cases, it's going to come down to timing, positioning, and dice. Mm-hmm. And timing is not necessarily something you can control, because who goes first in a turn is going to be a big factor in that. And that's dice that determines that. And obviously all your attacks are dice, which you don't control either. I mean, to a certain degree you do, but you don't. and then positioning, which I think that's the big one, which that actually comes down to both board choice and where you choose to place your fighters on the board during the game.
Yeah. So actually that's a good segue here, because we've talked about that's how Phil would spend his practice time. But what are the goals while you're practicing? I don't want to overlook the fact that, you know, while we play a lot and we're prepping for Adepticon, we don't play as much as some, especially some of the UK folks. But there might be people who are listening and they're getting ready to go to their first eight-person tournament. And so the goal of the practice is much more conservative, like just knowing your fighters. And I can say, for example, with Godsworn, because they all, there's no universal, like, hey, every person who inspires with Reavers, like, okay, everybody gets +1 speed, and then they get either damage or more accurate or possibly both. With Godsworn, it's like, well, this one gets faster, this one doesn't, this one gets an extra dodge, this one doesn't, this one flips to a shield for some reason, you know. So that's actually taken some time, because early on when we're practicing, I was like, hold on, I got to figure out who I'm inspiring here, and I'd flip all the fighters over trying to figure out, you know, who's getting what. And then another example of this, I was surprised, was when I was playing Goblins against you, Prague. Like, there was an example of a guy I'd been using for quite a while and did not realize that when he inspires, his net gets even more tangly. So you'd be surprised at some of the stuff you pick up. So learning your own fighter cards, basic stuff. Learning your power deck and your objective deck. And of the two of those, I think you probably agree that knowing your objective deck is probably the more crucial. They're both important, but having a good idea what's in the objective deck is more pivotal, I guess.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. Knowing... So if you're holding a grip of stuff and you know you can't score one, but you don't know if cycling it is going to draw you something you can score, that's not a good place to be sitting, right? Like, you really want to know, what are the things that I could be drawing into, so that you know whether it's worth it or not to spend an action to cycle an objective.
Right. Or even more so, like, I've got one, man, this objective looks real hard to accomplish. Probably rate my chances about 25%. Well, if you know your objective deck well enough to know that the rest of them in there are totally unscorable, then no, you know, you better, yeah, better hang on to it and go for it. Here's the other thing. Literally every game you play, you're going to look at your objective hand. You're going to look at both hands, but you're going to look at your power hand and your objective hand. You're going to have to make a decision on whether you're going to mulligan it. And if you don't know your objective deck well enough, then you cannot make an intelligent decision about what you might be digging for. So there's a matter of identifying what is not a great one for you. And sometimes it comes down to, like, if you played it enough, you've got almost like a gut instinct, like, nope, I can do better than this. And some of it is saying, yeah, okay, this is a matchup where I really, really want to have X, Y, or Z in my hand, and I need to go digging for that. And I know that I have it because I know this deck well enough, right? And again, emphasis on the objective deck, because there's only 12 in there. and that's where your glory comes from. The power deck, it's a slightly harder to count through and say, okay, I know that I'm of my seven remaining, I have, you know, these are all of them. And at any given time, I can probably think of what three or four of them are, you know,
mm-hmm.
without really stopping things. I just kind of go off that top of my head, but I like to get where I can say three cards left in the objective deck. I know what they are. And here's, you know, cause you end up with those situations where you're like, all right, I've got two draws left. Do I go digging for that third end phase, have a 2/3 chance of getting to it, or do I proceed? And then you can, you know, check the math on whether it makes sense to do it or not.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And some of that even plays into knowing the game state as well. So, like, say you've gotten to that point where you do know your deck, the reps, once you do know your deck, will help you to understand, where am I in this game, to know, is it important that I get one of those cards that I could draw into, or can I sit with what I have and feel pretty confident that I've already got this? A few examples from the last few games we played where, like, we sort of talked about it afterwards, and it was like, oh yeah, Davey, you could have just not engaged for the rest of the game and probably won this out, knowing that, like, you were ahead enough and what you had was enough to keep me out of the game. And that's sort of the thing that you have to kind of know your deck, and to the point where you then can factor the risks of your opponent's ability to outscore you based on what you know about your own stuff.
Sure. Here's another one. You already touched on this, is, well, one of your goals of practice should be learning what boards to use for your warband. And this is actually, the more boards that come into the game, the harder this gets. So we're up to, what, like 2, 4, 5, 6 physics, so 12? Is that where we're at?
That sounds right.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So yeah, with the most recent, the Forbidden Chambers pack, we're up to 12 different sides of boards. And you've done this pretty well. Like, when we're playing, you go straight for it. You know what you want to grab. You know what you're putting up. I think this is especially important with the if you've lost the role and you've got to put a board up and you don't know what the orientation is going to be. That's where you can really, really get burned badly, because the other person's got a little more time to kind of look and test a couple other boards, how they match up to that. But yeah, so you, for example, are you down to just two boards? You got the board if you lose, yep. Board if you win? Okay.
Yep, I've got two. I don't know the names of the boards because they're not printed anywhere on the boards, and I haven't studied that white dwarf enough to know what they're all called, but...
Hey, quick shout out to Underworlds DB, which now has a game boards tab, so you can go click on that. And
yeah, for sure. But yeah, so I've basically got it down to one where if I win, I know I've got the squared up matchup where I can put all four of my fighters within either right on the line or just one back from the line, which helps with being an aggro warband because I have less ground to cover. And then the other one is so that no matter what way the boards are oriented, I can pretty much have three of my four fighters fairly close. It gets harder with hallway matchups, but it's still better than the alternatives, because sure, almost every other board would leave me with like three of my four stuck farther from the fight, which is not what I want at all.
Yeah, and we'll get into the specifics of these, which boards you actually, we'll get the names and all that sort of thing when we'll probably do a dive into your warband once we've got the Adepticon results in, either in a, hey, look how awesome this did, or here's what you should definitely not do. yeah, and I don't feel like I'm there yet. I've got a couple. I know I need to sit down and take a look.
Yeah, I do feel like, though, you got a lot of mileage out of the new board with the three lethal hexes right next to each other.
Yeah, the lava pit of doom.
Yeah. And I think
one's called like Forbidden Chambers.
Ooh.
Well, that pack is. That's Forbidden Chambers board one and Forbidden Chambers board
okay,
two.
Okay, well, whatever.
Forbidden Ooh. Chamber number one.
Wait a sec. Yeah, why does all these other ones have their own names, but this one, these because they came out after the White Dwarf.
They just haven't gotten around to names
yet. Gotcha. So, board one.
Named them yet. Mm-hmm. Although, Aaron, when we played, when you had Stormcast, how did you like, what were you thinking of when you were trying to line up? Because you sort of chose to set up almost, it felt like almost a defensive setup, but you were playing aggro Stormcast. So I'm curious.
Yeah, but I think that was a function of the what you were playing at the same time, though, knowing that you were going to come knocking on my door. So I picked the Forbidden Chambers board two, which is where you get that three for where they're just in a line. So I know I definitely liked it because I like keeping my three dudes together. It made it pretty easy, despite the block text, to set up like, you know, counter charges and supports and things like that. So it was pretty slick. I recommend that one.
So back to, you know, talking about with when you're practicing for and trying to refine your board selection, one of the things I find difficult is, you know, like normally if you're experimenting with something, you're trying to isolate a variable and say, okay, like that is the, I got it. Like that was the thing that changed it. But there's so many variables in every game of this that it's always hard to say definitively. But I would encourage you, if you are doing this practice, like at least certainly early on, try a bunch of different boards because you might surprise yourself. And we've done that. Even if I've won the role, you know, back to back, I'll try different setups or try, you know, like the one I use the same board that Forbidden Chambers board one with the big lava pit. Like, okay, let me see how this matchup plays out if I set it diagonal and you've got to run through that lava pit. All right, now let me see what happens if I set it in hallway mode and you have to run through that lava pit. With obviously the common function being Magor's running through lava pits. So except for freaking Gartok, that guy can get out of here. Gartok.
I love him so much.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, so don't undervalue the board situation. Try them out. Even if you don't have access to all of them, you have at least with your starter set, whether you have the season one or season two, you have four, and that's a lot of things to try out. So, what else? So that kind of covers our main goals are like learning your power deck, objective deck, your fighter cards, learning your boards, and then learning the opposition. And we talked about that with Phil saying figuring out what your matchups are. But then it's not just that, but it's all the things that you're doing with your own. Now, once you've got that under wraps, then you try to start absorbing what the other, you know, you're practicing to kind of learn what fighters are problematic. Like if you're playing against Gitz, is Snurk a problem for me? If he is a problem for me, how do I deal with him? Do I have a way to kill him, or is it better for me to just, you know, run, give him a wide berth or something like that? So I would say that's kind of the last of the sort of five big things is play to learn your opposition. We kind of covered a lot of that. But,
yeah, definitely. and one other thing that I think we've talked about a couple times in our games, and I think this is maybe one of the hardest things that I've at least dealt with in preparing, is that once you're starting to get to that point where you're learning the opposition, you're then having to try and refine your play. Like, you know, okay, these are the tools that I'm going to be working with. These are the cards that I'm going to have. And then trying to figure out, okay, with these matchups, what do I do when things start going downhill so that I can try and deny glory to my opponent through my play style rather than like, oh, here's these card combos and, you know, this stuff that it's more about what am I doing as a player and less about how did I build my list and which fighters am I using and what dice am I rolling.
Sure. I agree. And I it's not even once it starts going south, in my opinion, like when we're talking about glory denial, right? Like if you can deny glory early, that is often more powerful than scoring it yourself. Right. But
yeah,
you can, to really effectively deny glory, you can only do that if you have a really good understanding of what you're up against. And so that's why it ends up being a risky proposition, is if you're not really sure what you're doing, then you end up slowing yourself down and not effectively denying glory. So this is where you can really get that last 5% push, is learn what to expect from the other side well enough. I mean, if you're super, I guess the one that we're talking about matchups in general, I guess if you are in a meta, or if you know that somebody's coming to the tournament that you particularly want to be able to beat, then it might be even as much as like paying attention if they're you know, posting a blog, or if you've played them a few times, is trying to remember what is in that person's deck specifically. I don't know if down to remembering cards, but like, here are the things that person likes to do or whatever. And so that's even more specific there. That's the secret sixth level to
get that insider info.
Yeah. And as far as the actual process of practicing, you know, some of it's just when you're doing just the stuff like I'm learning my fighters, I'm learning my deck. Some of that's just as easy as play a game. Doesn't matter who you're playing against, play a game. Learn your stuff. It's when you get to those later ends, or when you're trying those matchups, that like for us, what we've done is we'll bring the deck that we are planning to play in the tournament, and then another deck which we've either poached online or built ourselves, but that we think is important for some of the reasons that we talked about before. But something to keep in mind is that just because I pulled John Reese's Farstrider deck and ran it against you doesn't mean, and you kick the crap out of it, doesn't mean like, oh cool, I got John, you know, I can take down anybody, right? Like, there's a really broad expanse between having the deck and knowing how to pilot it to a really high level, right? So what I would say is, if you're doing this, then don't take more away from it than you should, right? Like, just because you beat Magor's in your two matches doesn't mean that you've got it on lockdown. You know, like for me, the last time we played, I took the Magor's down with Godsworn 2-0, but I won the board matchup both times, and we had like the craziest dice game in the first one. So
oh my god, so many crits.
It'd be foolish of me to say, okay, I got Magor's on lockdown. I don't even have to worry about that matchup. So don't take too much away from that. Take the things you can, but not don't let it make you overconfident. Is that what I'm dancing around?
Yeah, about? Yeah. I think it's just sort of like, don't read too much into one or two games. There's a lot of variables in this game, and if things happened to go your way a lot in those two games, it could have a skewed sort of view on that matchup. So I would say, like, don't feel like you know a matchup until you've done it like 6 or 8 or 10 times, where you know sort of all of the variables have been played out.
Sure. Well, and I guess the other thing is you can, that game or that match is going to count for more if you've got time to kind of hash it out with the opponent afterwards. So like,
oh yeah,
you know, that really, I don't know, enhances the worth a whole lot more if you have a chance to talk to the person from the other side. And then I guess the other thing, and this shouldn't have been a surprise, but you know, at times you're like, oh, I guess I'm gonna run this other deck, you know, like I'm gonna run Gits, and I'm not learning my Godsworn because I'm running these Gits. Well, while you're running that other deck, you know, to help your buddy out, you are learning, you're learning what it looks like from that side of the board, which is often as valuable, or I don't know. It's certainly useful as far as learning, hey, here's what, if there's a Gits player, here's what there is going through their head possibly, and here's what they're thinking of, and here's what looks scary from their side of the table. So now I know how to leverage that, right?
Or if you know, or if you end up getting paired off against your buddy at that tournament.
Yeah.
Perfect. Problem solved. All
right. Grudge matching Phil round one at Adepticon. Go.
Oh, that'd be crazy.
Yeah, so don't begrudge running something that's not what you're planning on playing. Like, it's you're learning from it too. All right. Well, and the last thing we're gonna hit is anybody got any more to hit about practice? I think we kind of ran that down pretty well. All right.
I think that's good.
last thing I was touch on is your considerations. So this, you're going to a big tournament, or you're going to your first tournament, or whatever the case, day of or the night before. Some of the things you want to make sure to do. And this sounds really basic, but the number of times I've gone to even just practice the game and realize, you know, like, oh, okay, I guess I'm going to turn around now that I've driven 10 minutes this way because I didn't bring any figures. I've got my box, but pretty hard to play that tournament without your figs. So what I like to do is bundle everything up, set it, and then check it one more time. And talking about checking with count out your cards, because if you are making lots of swaps, there's nothing more demoralizing. I'm trying to think when this happened. I don't like where I'm drawing up my power cards, and all of a sudden there's a gold objective card sitting in the middle of my power deck.
Like, oh, no, like, yeah.
What have I done here? So what I do is before going to an event, and then before each game and after each game, I'll count out. There's 12 objective cards. There's 20 power cards. All right. Now I know what didn't fall on the floor, or something like that. And then I'm going to, you know, mess up every game from here on out because I accidentally left, ready for action under table 19. So
definitely.
I think at some point we'll do a ep on storage solutions. It sounds like something Aaron could probably really get excited about. Oh yeah.
right up his alley.
But I can tell you right now, with six boards, and a couple deck boxes and a thing for counters, like my current thing of trying to jam it all in a Nightfall box is getting a little ridiculous. Like it's definitely staggering under the weight of what I'm trying to fit in there. So.
Yeah. Yeah. When the box top doesn't quite like come down all the way, like, yeah, you know, you're starting to have problems.
I mean, saying doesn't quite would be really charitable right now. Like, it doesn't even come close.
Yeah.
Well, and it's because of that, like, that you end up having to spread your, you know, supplies across different containers, and that is just an opportunity for error, like an opportunity for you to mess something up. So, like, I think that all the more reason to be focused on making sure that you have everything that you need.
Yeah. Right. And then last thing, what I've been doing is when they update the designer's commentary, is I'll print it out, and that's actually getting kind of obnoxious because it's getting pretty long at this point. But print that out, and if you are running, like, I would have considered doing this when Extreme Flank was not yet banned, is highlighting that spot just because it was such a weird, you know, like it didn't play the way it seemed like it ought to play. So it would, if you're including a card that you think ends up is going to have some confusion, it's worth kind of earmarking or highlighting that so you can flip to it if you need to help somebody out on that. So
definitely. I think the one that I've seen come up the most that people have been like, wait, what is this? And you have to reference the document is, can I score this score immediately after I drew it?
Right.
I just don't think people have had enough time to internalize that list yet.
Sure.
So having that available is going to be very important.
Yep. All right. I think that about covers what we wanted to cover. If you've got some hot tips for starting out, for somebody getting ready for a tournament, feel free to share them with us. You can hit us at WTHcast or whatthehexcast@gmail.com. I think next episode, our plan, so this episode will drop a couple days after Adepticon, about 3 or 4 days. You'll be hearing this 3 or 4 days.
Real after. Useful.
Yeah, yeah. Well, then you're prepping for a different tournament. But from there on out, we will probably be looking one way or the other, recapping what we did. And I'm thinking about having us do one episode, a deep dive into Phil's process from start to finish on his deck, and then same for me, just because it's something that we can talk about in pretty good detail. It's something that we'll know pretty well at that point. As always, if you want to find more of the Mortal Realms content, you can do that at www.themortalrealms.com. If you'd be so kind as to drop us a review, rate us on your pod listener of choice. Special thanks to Ann Baths, who dropped us a real nice review on iTunes. And then on Facebook, got some great feedback from Jonathan Davis, Matthew Wilfred, kind words in our last episode. Appreciate you guys saying that. For this episode, my recommended listening for you is I Come Prepared by Kanan and Damian Marley. It's off his Troubadour album. And I think that's going to do it for us. You guys got anything else?
Nope.
All right.
Oh, one last thing. I forgot to mention that for being prepared for a tournament, it would probably be a good idea to have something to take notes with, because a lot of tournaments want you to report glory differentials. And I can't remember how many times I got to the end of a match and went, okay, how many glory did we score across the games?
Yeah, good point. And then you can jot down names and such, and then you can talk about them on your podcast, which everybody's going to have. All right. That's it for What the Hex. I've been Davey.
This has been Phil.
This is Aaron.
But I started as soon as we were on, so we were
yeah.
We were going for a while. With,
I get you,
and then we had a little breakdown in the middle where I had to go look up some stuff. So,
like a sweet heavy metal song breakdown in the middle.
Oh God, what have I done?
So, mistakes were made. Mistakes were made. Yeah.